Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro, and this week my guest is the Mac Observer contributor, John Keat. John, good afternoon.
Hey, John. It's good to be with you.
It's good to talk to you. Thanks for being on the show. You are a TMO regular contributing editor. You're also a successful New York attorney, and we share a common interest, TV technology, especially this 4K stuff.
Yeah, I think we share more than a few common interests, but that one is relevant for us today because I think you're in the process of getting yourself something new.
I am. I'm inching closer and closer. Yes. First, one of our readers recently suggested when I wrote a 4K article that you and I might be the very same person in disguise. So one of the purposes of this show, and I think that's because you and I are often critical of Apple in a similar writing style. And so this reader thought, oh, no, man, it's just two different editor names. And it's really the same guy behind the scenes. But now we can prove that we're two different people.
I think they may still require video proof of both of us.
Oh, okay. Well, just haul out your Mac and do voice print analysis and you'll figure it out. So I don't have a real detailed and fixed agenda today with you. Because recently we had a chat about television, and I thought, well, why don't we just do this for background mode and just geek out about TV tech and kind of share with the listeners our thoughts about the 4K revolution and our own technical approach. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
Well, why don't you start, because you're ahead of me. You bought, I think, an LG 65-inch 4K TV back around Christmas.
Yeah, you know, it was before the last Black Friday thing. I got a 2016 LG 65-inch OLED, the curved version, which they've stopped making. When I first got it, I thought, I'm just getting it to get it because OLED prices finally kind of came down into – they're still very pricey, but they're not – insanely pricey, like in the $10,000, $20,000 price level. They dropped down to $2,500 is what I paid for mine. And when I got it, you know, it was interesting. The first impression I got was kind of like, one, it comes really not calibrated well. It's oversaturated. It's like an LCD trip by a comic book writer that can't get enough saturation, right? It's burning your retinas. But when you tune it in, to be more reasonable, it kind of seems similar. But then over a month or two, it really started to, in subtle ways, make a really positive impression where I went from, I probably spent $2,500 for no good reason because I already had a 65-inch LED TV before that, to, man, I'm really happy I got this. And it's not just like the little pops of color that show their way through where just the way that the light comes out of this, and the blacks are super black on this thing. But it's the nature of the light emission on this is kind of the difference to me, like psychologically, between sitting under fluorescent lights all day where you're kind of being depressed by that and you're not sure why, versus to being out in the sunshine, right? And you're kind of happier just because the nature of the light, at least for me, makes me happier. So there's that quality of light that emits from there being just somehow happier.
I wonder if it's something to do with the LED backlighting, the color temperature of that, and how it interacts with the LCD crystals and the effective color gamut that comes out of it. I don't know. I haven't looked into the color temperature differences of an OLED, but I've seen one up close, and the reason I like it is because it's the closest thing to the plasma that I currently have, and I just thought I wouldn't be happy going from plasma to backlit LCD, because you just never really do get the blacks completely turned off, and you don't get the high contrast.
So, one, I was also a Panasonic plasma user for a while, and then I bit the bullet and got the LEDs screens. And you're right. It will warm your heart to know that the black levels are even far superior to even the plasmas.
How can that be? Because when the plasma pixels off, it's off as well.
All I can tell you is probably the nature of the glass and substrate technology that they've developed over, you know, since plasmas were kind of at their peak probably, I don't know, 7-8 years ago to versus now, it is enhanced. So now it's spooky off. Like there are times when the screen goes black, kind of because of an interstitial, and I'm worried the TV flipped off. That's how black it is.
Well, you know, one of the things we have to worry about with LCD TVs is regional control of the backlighting. There's side lit, which means that you pipe the light in from the side LEDs, and then it technically they make it evenly lit in the background so that the LED light can shine through the pixels. But when you do that, you don't have control of the local area. So there's a technology where they do a matrix backlighting, where they have the backlighting actually in LED matrices in a grid behind the display, and you can regionally turn off. You'll see references to like 16 sectors or 32 sectors or something like that.
Yep.
And the TV picture knows when to go black in a sector. But that's a really crude way of turning off the backlighting to achieve black levels. And it's okay, and it works great. And I've talked to people who have a TV like that. But it's technically dissatisfying for me, sort of like Apple's Fusion drives. It was just, you know, unnervingly technical for me. And I thought, I'm going to steer away from that.
So I think there's something to it, and the blacks are so good at this point that they're almost, it's basically disturbingly good, because I have I'm going to try not to curse. my cable company, like many cable companies, does a fair amount of compression on whatever they received as over the air broadcast or whatnot. And you really see the compression artifacts in the black levels, because most TVs don't show them. And all of a sudden, you start seeing these deep, deep, dark burgundy blocks. And I'm not talking little blocks. On my TV, it's 65 inch. Some of these blocks are, you know, like 3, 4, 5 inches square that you're seeing artifacting in the very dark regions that normally on most sets you just wouldn't even notice or notice very little. And it becomes painfully
clear. This was on your LCD TV?
No, this is on the OLED, on the new one, like, because the black levels are so accurate, and the compression, I don't think the compression algorithms that are being used by the cable companies kind of account for how good the black levels are on this TV.
Like, that's interesting.
Yeah.
But maybe streaming does better then.
It does. I have so this is one of the really great things. I can't believe I even said this, because I planned when I got the TV to never interface with the smart TV component on it, but WebOS, which came back from the Palm days, right?
When
John Rubinstein left Apple, he waited for his NDA to expire after a year or two or whatever it was, and then he came to Palm and he launched WebOS. And a lot of people actually to this day are saying that, you know, a lot of iOS 11 is basically still ripping off parts of WebOS. But they ended up open sourcing it after that whole thing fell apart through the Hewlett-Packard kind of non-care of that phone technology. And LG picked it up and uses it on their TVs. And version 3.0 and newer is spectacularly good. It's very quick and liquidy, and the UI is pretty smartly arranged. So it's actually an excellent a smart TV, you know, component that's built into the TV. And what's nice about that is when I'll watch like Grand Tour off of Amazon, and that comes
great
down.
Great show. I love it.
Yeah. And it's a great show. And it's a great show to show off this TV, because it's HDR 4K. And the interesting parts are, if you're familiar with the show like Top Gear or actually Grand Tour, they have these parts where they're in a studio and they're members of the studio that are just, you know, normally kind of blurs. In 4K, you can identify every single person in that audience. It's kind of disturbing, like how incredibly detailed that is. But even more impressive for me than the 4K, which is kind of almost a party gimmick. Like, it's neat that I could see the person's face in the background, but in the end, I don't care. The HDR, the way that the TV automatically flips and knows how to control its kind of dynamic range and colors on at least those Amazon programs, is really spectacular.
Now, this is HDR 10, right? Which is high dynamic range and a 10-bit color depth, right?
That's a good question. LG has one its own proponent. I don't know what exactly is being broadcast over Amazon. Like, is it HDR10? Is it LG? Is it some? I don't know what.
I think it's HDR10. I think.
Yeah, I don't know which of the competing HDR modes is actually flipped on, because the way it works, which was interesting, it's not that you set the TV on to HDR mode. You can, but it's not the way that HDR works, which was surprising to me. Normally, you set your TV to cinema mode or vibrant mode or whatever mode, right? Like, you set that, and then it enforces that on whatever the signal comes in. What happens with HDR, when you watch HDR content, the content gives a switch to the TV and says, hey, I have HDR, a format.
Right. And those ought to recognize the metadata then.
Yeah, and it flips on automatically. And video games, some video games honor this, some video games you have to force it on, which is kind of interesting. But at least the stuff that's coming off Amazon, I love it because I have to do nothing. Like, it just flips it on, it does a great job, and it's phenomenal. Like, it's one more step that I don't have to deal with. So I wish
How are you delivering, if I may ask, how are you delivering Amazon Prime Video to your LG OLED?
So I have like four different ways, because I have an Apple TV on there. I have my TiVo on there. I have an Xbox. I have a PlayStation. All of them have, right, you know.
But Apple TV Amazon doesn't have the Amazon app yet.
It does not.
So you must be using AirPlay then.
And it certainly doesn't have it in 4K or HDR, right, because we have the Gen 4. I have the Gen 4 Apple TV. So if I'm doing it through there, it's a lesser experience. So,
but it's got to be AirPlay, right? Because there's no app yet for the Apple TV.
Yeah. So there's a multitude of ways to do it. I do it one of two ways. I'll do it most of the time. I'll do it right through the native app on the smart TV component through WebOS. It's phenomenal.
Oh, does WebOS have the Amazon app as a native smart TV app?
Yep, and they have an app store too.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's surprising, maybe because I went in with such low expectations, but I was shocked how good WebOS was compared to the other smart TV things I've seen on Samsungs and other sets. It's just phenomenal. And the funny thing is, my buddy Walt, he had previous gen LG monitors, and they had WebOS 1 and 2, and they were not ready for prime time at all. So, like, you want a 3.0 or newer set for sure. And they've been actually pretty good about doing updates, like, to the firmware. Like, when my set first came out, this was a difficult thing in 2015 and 2016 to have HDR and a game mode, a combined mode, because game mode have low latency response times. Like, you're hopefully under 40 milliseconds kind of lag that you're dealing with, because you can't really, like, lip sync a video game, right? Like, you can't do that for the input output on the controllers to jive with it. So you need a low latency connection, and it was an either or choice in 2015. You can either have a game mode but no HDR or HDR and no game mode. So they pushed a firmware update that got that down to about 35 milliseconds, and
how many firmware updates have you applied to your LG?
I've applied now four, but I got it kind of early days, right? So, like, if you were getting one now, most people wouldn't care. Like, I bought at a time where the tech curve for a lot of these protocols was still in high development, right? Oh, yeah. Like, they were changing. And now I'm sure they're still tweaking it, but they've kind of settled on at least a few of the HDR formats as being cool. And,
well, that's why I'm inching closer to making a purchase decision, because with all the studying I've done, I don't see that there's going to be anything new on the horizon. You know, we got 10-bit color. Sure, 12-bit color is coming, but it's coming down the road. 8K is coming. We'll talk about that later. That's way down the road. HLG is now hybrid log gamma, which allows a version of HDR, kind of a way to trick your TV into honoring HDR over broadcast mode, which can't carry the metadata because the ATSC broadcast system wasn't designed to carry metadata with the video data. So HLG kind of tricks the system into doing that. So we've got TVs now with HLG and Dolby Vision, and we've got HDR10 getting to be a standard. And Apple TVs coming out, we think, soon with all those three items. And so things are kind of settling out, as you just said. And if you bought a TV today, it'll be good to go for 10 years.
You're a long time buyer compared to me, but I was looking at it. I mean, my ideal size for a TV set is somewhere around 160 to 240 inches diagonal is what I want. So when that happens in, you know, whatever crazy resolution, then I'll be done, right? I won't care after that what happens. But until then, I'm kind of.
So you want an entire wall of your living room to just be video, like baseball stadiums, or you have just a video wall.
Yeah, you know, I had that for a while, actually. Like I do kind of weird stuff for work from time to time, and I like having this whiteboard. I had a custom built glass whiteboard put in, and underneath the whiteboard, the glass that was clear, I put in 4 65-inch panels, LED panels, and they were rotated to be in portrait orientation, but four across, which ended up with a 21:9 aspect ratio, which is perfect for real movie watching. Nice. So I played video game when I wasn't doing whiteboarding stuff. So the idea is like you display like work documents or something on that, and then you could write on the screen, right over the screen, and mark it up, and you know, take a photo or whatever of it for later work as you're whiteboarding on it. It was super useful for that. But when I wasn't using it for that, I tried, of course, to play video games on it and watch movies on it. And it's incredible what that feels like. One, the 21, it's weird to me that the 21:9 aspect ratio is slowly breaking into the workspace world.
I have one. I have a 21:9 Hewlett Packard. It's called a Z34C. And it's curved, and it's 21:9, and it's just awesome.
Yeah, and I saw your review of it, and it's fantastic, and I think it's great. And I have like a little tech group kind of social thing that goes on, and we recommended that. And even though it has less resolution than, say, a 4K or a 5K display, everyone is happier with it overall because it gives you the feeling of more desktop space.
Yeah, it's 3440 instead of 3840, which is just a little less. Yeah. But the size of the menu items and the size of the display is well matched to the pixel density and your vision distance. It's perfect.
Yeah, and it almost doesn't matter what the overall pixels are because you can still see a full page, you know, two or three full page pages side by side, which is what matters. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's catching on there, and it just drives me nuts that it's not catching on in the entertainment world, because it's I'm telling you, once you watch 21:9 on a real 21:9 TV that's big enough, you're like, forget those.
If you have a 16:9 TV, which is 1.78:1, if you have a 16:9 TV and you're watching letterboxed movies that are 21:9 or 2.32 or 2.2 aspect to one or somewhere in that range, the letterboxing at the top of the bottom isn't really that noticeable.
It's not, especially if your set is really big, which is why I want it bigger and bigger and bigger, because then, you know, if I have a 65 inch, the letterboxing probably reduces that to be an effective, say, 55 inch, right, or something like that, which is still good enough. But I'm telling you, once it gets really big and at that aspect ratio, it's somehow transforming. It really makes a big difference. And I wish it would catch on more. But I think the real problem is that it has the reverse problem. Since a lot of media is 16:9, now if you get only, right, I think the largest ones I saw outside of the crazy, you know, $200,000, you know, one-off almost displays that they made got to be around like the 55 or whatever size was around the max for the 21:9 sets. And the problem is now you got letterboxing on the sides, right? And so your effective size on a 21:9 for a lot of media goes from 55 down to like under, you know, 50. And you're kind of like, this is small, right?
That might be a good reason to buy a bigger TV, even though you can't exploit the resolution. Yeah.
Yeah, one way or the other. But anyway, it was transformative. And ever since I had that, I've been, one, thinking about rebuilding it now with kind of better tech to redo that. And I might end up doing that as a stopgap because we're years before we get to, you know, the wallpapering our stuff. Even though I think LG is selling a current set, I think it's a 77-inch OLED, and it's basically wallpaper. The guts of the TV are in a separate box that's connected by this super ribbon of thin ribbon that you could basically plaster over or paint over or tack down. And it will bend if you wanted to, but you could basically just put it onto a wall. You're tacking it on a wall like a painting. Yeah. Yeah. And it's we're getting to that point where I think these things are going to roll out, right? And you're just going to have as big a set as you want.
We can talk about it in the second segment, but John, right now we have to take a break.
Excellent.
Folks, we'll be right back in 60 seconds. Stay with us after we take a commercial break. I'm talking to TMO contributing editor John Keat. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm speaking with John Keat. John, you may have just opened my eyes about something. I had always assumed that 4K was a big chunk to swallow for a lot of people who just switched to high definition in the 2010 to 14 range or so, and most content on TV now is high definition with very little 4K broadcast. But and so I assumed that 8K and anything bigger would be, you know, way down the road. But, you know, putting my science fiction hat on and listening to you, I can believe that there'll come a day when we really will have, as a matter of fact, these very large displays, you know, 16K, 32K, painted onto our living room walls, a wall of video.
Yeah, or through augmented reality as well. I could see, you know, screens, virtual screens being everywhere, right? And you can make them as big or small in your virtual field as you like. But I think, Dell, I think last year released an 8K display for your desktop. It's actually pretty spiffy. And I forget who the manufacturer has just announced that an 8K is coming out.
Sharp.
Coming out next year. It's not OLED, so it's dead on arrival for me. Like, if it's not OLED, I'm not even talking about it.
Right.
By the way, I investigated. I know Samsung is trying to market the heck out of their quantum dot, but it's quantum not is really what that is. It's a total joke. If you see it in person, it's nothing like OLED, no matter how much they wave their hands and try to say it is. I pray that this isn't one of those beta versus VHS moments where the worst technology loses and kind of like plasma loss, right, to LED, because of basically better lying marketing. But Quantum Dot is... it is no OLED replacement. So anyway, there's until that comes out, 8K in OLED form, I'm kind of seriously uninterested. But it justifies my purchase somewhat and mocks my purchase somewhat last year, in that I figured that the TV, when I got the OLED, it's good for me for, if I'm really lucky, 3 or 4 years before the 8K stuff comes in and at a significantly new size. And I think what's interesting too is 8K.
Oh, so are you saying you think 8K might go 21.9 and be done?
I don't know about that, but if 8K goes big enough, meaning like I can get a 95-inch screen, then I might be okay with it anyway, because even in letterbox form, that'll still be like a 70, you know, 8-inch effective 21:9, and that'll be fine as well. So it's kind of the aspect ratio is important, but if you get something huge enough, you kind of don't care, kind of like really the projectors, right? They don't always fully project into the space that's there. They have extra space to mess with the aspect ratios, because the directors are always using extra wide and extra wide to, you know, sometimes for their movies. But what was interesting to me was 8K is a significant jump because it's basically four times the resolution of 4K. It's four 4K displays side by side, much like 4K is for HD displays side by side.
Yeah, but you got to sit really close to 8K to take advantage of it. I mean,
which I do.
I know. The other day you showed me how close you sit, but for a lot of people, you know, in my case, sitting 6 feet away from a 55-inch is where I have to be to take advantage of 4K. And right, if I sit any further back, it's retina. So it's to make your 8K non-retina and take advantage of the extra resolution, you have to sit at about 3 feet for a 55-inch.
So this is kind of the same argument people used on 4K, yet here we are, you know, 4K has become the norm. So
yeah, because of HDR.
You may be right. You may be right. You are right as far as at least to me, because my opinion is the HDR is much more of a big impact on the overall feeling than the resolution. But nonetheless, there is a significant, just kind of forgetting the practicality of it and looking just at the pure tech, there's a huge bump in resolution going from 4 to 8K. Once you're at 8K, the new cables that have come out, the HDMI 2.1 spec, goes up to a theoretical 10K. I don't remember if it does full 60 frames at 10K. It might only do 30 frames at 10K. But nonetheless, it goes up to 10K. So my feeling is, at that point, you're not getting a doubling. You're getting, you know, some percentage more resolution at a resolution that's already so insane that I don't care. Like, beyond 8K, it starts to get it's pretty stupid at 8K, but it's irrelevant at 10K, right? Like, the difference from 8 to 10. So I don't know if 10 will catch on as much as 8 seems to be catching on to me, because this is very early days. I think commercial releases of 8K sets are coming.
Well, there's no 10K technology on the horizon. I think the cable was designed for 10K to give it some technical latitude.
Yeah, I think I hopefully that's right. And like I said, and even if someone does make a 10K panel, I don't think I personally won't care because the delta becomes small. But 8K I do, particularly, like, at some point I want to get an 8K display for my desktop. And that has a lot of awesome practical, not at the size that Dell released, which was like a 34-inch, which is just, you know, at that point it's almost microfiche. But you could see having a 65-inch display for your, like, mega display on your desktop, like a real mega desktop. But
oh, I don't know. This 34-inch Hewlett-Packard uses up most of my desktop. It's like an aircraft carrier. I couldn't imagine 65 inches. I don't think my desk is 65 inches wide.
Yeah, well, it might.
That's
might
diagonal, float. I know, but still, it's 80% 65.
Yeah, 55 might
inches.
Only the stand has to fit, John, right? The rest can just hang
only
over.
The stand has to fit. So you have some hangover.
That's right. And as much as, you know, everyone said, it's funny, my girlfriend, I have this argument with everyone that I've bought a TV for, and they're like, no, I only need a 50 inch, it's too big for whatever. I'm like, let me tell you, no matter what you say, you will get used to it. You will get used to it, and then you'll be like, I don't know how I live without this. So she was like, oh, 50-inch maximum. So I get her a 60-inch because physically it was impossible to fit more in kind of the cubby that she had for it than the 60-inch. I got, like, the maximum one she wanted. And the complaints about it were, oh, my gosh, it's too big of it. Yeah, a week later, it was like, I love this TV set. This is the greatest size ever, right? Oh, yeah. So
for a lot of people, it depends on price, right? I mean, for example, there's a Sony 55-inch OLED now. It sells for $3,000. That's a big, hefty chunk of change for most people. But it could be affordable at, say, Black Thursday this coming year if the price comes down another $500. Right. Because you're paying $2,500, and that's about what you would pay for a very good MacBook Pro. So it's digestible. Right. But you get into a 65-inch OLED, and you're looking at $4,000 or $5,000. And that's just too much for most families.
So anyone that's shopping right now, you can definitely, so, you know, the Sonys are excellent and they have their own circuitry, but they're using the LG panels, which really are premium. And I think the 2017 Sonys are using the 2016 LG panels. And the new 2017 LG panels aren't much, like, the difference between 2014 to 2015 was huge. The difference between 2015 to 2016 was huge. The difference between 2016 to 2017 on these panels not that huge. It's sure it's better, but you're starting to flatline on the curve of improvement cycles here. They're getting better at this, so the deltas are smaller and smaller.
Well, that's something interesting for the listeners to know. If you buy Sony, Sony's using LG panels, and the way LG can justify that is they're LG selling Sony's last year's panels in order to for them to have the top of the line stuff for themselves. So that's a good thing to know if you're a buyer and you're trying to decide between Sony and LG for your OLED display.
But the Sony design just
well, I've written
so
about that new A1E at the Mac Observer.
So sexy.
The kickstand
It's just so sexy. So it's worth it in that regard. But if you wanted just a really top of the market 65-inch panel, if you get the 2016s, well, you can't get them really because they've sold out at this point. But they were if you were getting them at the sweet part of the curve, you were able to get the 65 inches for I paid, like I said, $2,500. On them. They went up a little bit after I got them, but you could have scored them that way. The current models, the current replacements of the 2017s, which are a little bit better in some ways, and a little worse in some ways, like they don't have 3D support. So if you're into 3D, that may be a loss. I don't care about 3D, so it wouldn't make a difference to me.
3D is dead. It's a dead technology. No new TV has it.
So, those go for the equivalent models go for the 65 inches for $3,100. And I bet you, like you said, if you wait till kind of the Black Friday timeframe, you'll be able to score them for $2,500 ish again. Yeah. I don't see it may be even lower at this point because, you know, it's 1 year further. So the prices tend to creep further and further over time. So you can do it, but probably not through the Sony. The Sonys are always a bit more expensive, and they're gorgeous. I mean, it's just such a great design.
One of the reasons to buy a Sony, I've read and been told, is that the scalers in the Sonys are very, very good. Scaler means you're going to be feeding your 4K TV mostly high-definition content at 2K. And so what's going to have to happen is each one of those high-definition pixels is going to have to be interpolated and converted into four 4K pixels. And the quality of the hardware and the speed of the hardware to do that scaling up from one pixel to four pixels at every location on your display, every 60 times a second, means that the scaler has to be very, very good. And Sony has a good reputation for that.
So I can tell you I'm pretty sensitive to scalers, like I mentioned the blotchiness and whatnot. So I've had some TVs with not great scalers, and I've had some TVs with good scalers. Our old Panasonics, by the way, had great scalers in them on the plasmas. So on the LGs, at least, they're really good, especially for HD up to 4K. It's phenomenal. Like, it just looks great all the time. You don't really see artifacting. I always turn the soap opera effect stuff off because...
Can you explain the soap opera effect?
So the soap opera effect is most original content, especially like, say, a movie, was filmed at, you know, 24 or maybe 30 frames a second. And what you're doing on a TV, a lot of TVs have 60 cycles a second or even 120 cycles a second. And so what the TV will do is it'll say, look, I have all this extra time. I could smooth like what this ball looks like. Normally, if the ball is going, say, 60 miles per hour across the screen, right, at 24 frames a second, you may only have four dots that actually show on your screen to give it the effect of speed. And the soap opera effect says, since I have extra cycles, I can interpolate. I can say the ball between those four spots, I know where it would have been at that time frame. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to generate a ball that didn't exist in the film in between to make it look much smoother. And so, and the reason it's called the soap opera effect is because movies are shot at 24 frames a second and soap operas were shot at 30. So soap operas have this smoother feel because there's more frames and it has a certain character to the video that you're used to. If you watch soap operas, at least in the old days, had a different feel to them. And what would happen is because 24 frames don't divide nicely into 60. into 30 or 60.
32. Yes, so you have this 3:2 interpolation thing.
That's right. Like on a couple of cycles, they'll squeeze in three extra, but because it doesn't divide equally on the last part, they'll only squeeze in two extra.
That causes what's called jitter, I think.
Yeah. And so I can't stand this because to me it turns so some people love it because everything looks more smooth and liquid, especially at 120 frames when you're doing this. I can't stand this because I'm old, I guess, and I've just gotten used to, I want to see the film the way it was produced, right? I want to see those just the frames as they were there. I don't want to see any interpolation. It freaks me out when I watch TV, and if it's not a soap opera, I don't want to see it looking like a soap opera. So
some people are very curious about it.
That's right.
Yeah. Cool.
That's right. So you got to turn, you know, I turned that off pretty immediately, but now I forget where we I forget.
Well, we're about running out of time, John. Yeah. We've got time for maybe one more side topic, but we're really quickly running out of time. Is there something you want to add to wrap this awesome discussion up?
One, kudos on your last interview, with the editor there and Car and Driver. And I was listening to them. Yeah, it was really, it was a good interview in that I really disagree with a lot of stuff that Eddie was talking about. But I like the fact that he was so open about kind of the topics that he was talking about. But one thing that was interesting to me was that he was bemoaning, and I think maybe you were a little bit too, there are car drivers that drive cars as enthusiasts, right? And if everything goes automated, you know, does that stop, right? Does it either get legislated away or people stop? And I hate to say, like, you know, I think he was somewhat optimistic about it, but I was really pessimistic about it. I think, like, I don't know when the time frame is going to happen, but basically there will be no more human drivers at a certain point. And
well, Eddie made the point that he thought there was going to be a mixture for a long time.
There may be, and it's you know, his speculation is as good as anybody's, I suppose, on that. But
I've got my 1999 Lamborghini Gallardo, and I ain't giving it up, and there's nobody can take it from me. So.
I got news for you. They're already not allowing that.
I don't have one of those, by the way.
They're already not allowing cars like that in Paris, right? And there are times when there's congestion stuff in London where they don't allow certain types of cars over a certain age, and it's going to happen. It's just going to be slowly banned out. Yeah, that exists today. And the real proxy for this, I think, is and this is one of my pet peeves about all these car magazines, and I hate them all because in the sense that they live in a different world that's not reality. Like, if you're buying a Lamborghini, you have, as a real buyer of one of those things, you have a very different mindset than some guy that gets to drive it as a toy for a week and then not have to maintain it, not have to live with it on real roads, you know, daily. So their criteria and what a real person's criteria is always different. And they live in this bubble where they always bemoaning, like, oh, we need another manual Honda Accord. And don't get me wrong, I love driving manual cars. But that ship has sailed so long ago, and not to mention that dual clutches are basically, unless you're driving rally, basically superior in every way in the sport or road manner. And as much as I personally love rowing the gears myself, the market's long ago spoken about this, right? Yeah. This is deader than a doornail. Yeah. And in the same way that people don't bother to feel the extra, you know, joie de vivre of driving a manual, they are not going to care about driving, period. They're just going to sit and, you know, send mean tweets while they're driving, while the car's driving them. And that's what they're going to see to it.
All right. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. That's a lot for the listeners to ponder, both today on televisions and last week's with Eddie Alterman. A lot of good stuff. Listeners, I hope you're enjoying the shows lately. They've been awesome. John, I want to thank you for being my guest on the show. This was great.
Thanks for having me, John.
Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
You could contact me by sending me mean tweets. No, by sending me emails on at johnk@macobserver.com.
Excellent. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show again. Thank you for joining us this week. We'll see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.